from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson. On November 5th, 2012, Barack Obama looked out at the Iowa crowd and got a bit misty-eyed. It had only been 8 years since his 2004 keynote address first rocketed him onto the national scene. And now, 8 years later, he was about to give his last campaign speech. That iconic scene, along with Mitt Romney's memorable 47% moment and Barack Obama's own inexplicably awful first debate performance, are all captured in Dan Baltz's new book, Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. Dan Baltz, the chief correspondent for The Washington Post, joins us to talk about elections past and future after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. You can already see the signs. Hillary Clinton back in the public eye, Chris Christie's every move analyzed. And for you true political junkies, the first David Yepsen sighting has already taken place in Iowa. All of which is to say the first faint noises of campaign 2016 are underway. And that means it's particularly apt to have Dan Baltz join us for this next hour of Forum. Baltz is chief correspondent for The Washington Post and one of the nation's preeminent political journalists. His new book unwinds the last campaign, the 2012 campaign, what happened, why it happened, and what it portends for the next battle for the White House. The book is called Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. And Dan Baltz joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
Happy to have you join us.
Well, I'm pleased to be with you.
Thank you. You write in your book that beyond all of the fascinating sort of inside baseball and strategic elements of any campaign, there are also big themes, big topics that matter. And among them, you focused on the economy, the polarization of the American public and the great demographic changes in our country. And I want to talk about those and begin with the question of the polarization that took place in the last campaign and that it is, of course, still very much with us because of what it may portend for the next one. Why have we not been able to make any more progress? Why were we not able to in the last campaign, particularly when you think of President Obama as being this person who rocketed to notice by talking precisely about getting beyond red states and blue states, and yet we're still stuck in that very same point of polarization? Why can we not advance beyond that?
It's a great question, and it's the great conundrum of our politics today. We have gotten to a point where the philosophical divide between the two parties and between people who identify as Republicans or identify as Democrats is not just wide, it's deep and it's embedded. And we used to think that was one of the reasons we had elections, was to have these debates and arguments and then ultimately have the American people give us a judgment as to which direction they really want to go. What we've seen over the last, half dozen or 10 years is conflicting signals on which way we want to go. We've elected Democrats and we've elected Republicans to the White House. We've had Democratic control of the Congress and we've had Republican control of the Congress and we've had divided government at times. And I think that there was a hope after President Obama was first elected in 2008, that, as you say, we could get beyond this, that we could go to something approaching a postpartisan era. And he seemed to have drawn on the inspiration of others and the hopes and dreams of others to get us to that place. But what we saw immediately after that election, that historic election in 2008, was that the country repolarized very quickly. And it has been that way ever since. And as a result, we had a big argument in 2012, and yet it did not resolve the differences. And they are still deeply embedded in our politics.
And is the opposition that the Republican Party put forward to President Obama from the get-go, different in some way than, I mean, there's always the opposing party opposes, of course. But I'm interested in knowing from your point of view, as someone who's covered so many campaigns and so many newly constituted governments, as to whether there is something different right now about the sort of hard line we're going to oppose no matter what that seems to be at least the case now.
Well, we saw after President Obama was elected and in the early stages of 2009 that the Republicans did adopt a posture of saying we're going to oppose just about every major initiative he put forward. Some of that was for philosophical reasons. They did have disagreements about the size of the stimulus package and the composition of it, certainly about the health care plan. But there was also a political notion in that, which is that the fastest route back to power for the Republicans would be to oppose what he was doing and take that to the voters. And in fact, they did that in 2010, and the Republicans were rewarded with 63 additional seats in the House of Representatives and a lot of major gains in the states. Now, what happened after that, I think, is important, and that is that that brought in another group, the Tea Party-infused part of the new Congress and in the House, and they came in more determined than, I think, past freshman classes not to do business as usual, not to go along to get along, not to agree with their leaders. And they have fought with their leaders, or they have directed their leaders ever since. And they have been very hard line about what they want to do. And I think that that has created an extra barrier to getting some things done.
And within the way our campaigns work, Dan, does that serve to further that polarization that much more in the way in which you spend a lot of time in the book going through the Republican primary process? Are our elections organized in such a way that it furthers that, and that in order to win, for example, the Republican nomination, the more polarized you act, the better?
Well, up to a point, and I think that's always been true, that that people who vote in primary elections in the presidential campaign tend to be not fully representative of the party as a whole. If it's in the Republican Party, you tend to see a more conservative part of the party turn out for the primaries. And in Democratic contests, you see a similar, that the primary electorate tends to be somewhat more liberal. So that's one element. But, Dave, I think there's another element, and that is the way campaigns are conducted today. Mm-hmm. If you think about the way we watch campaigns play out and the kind of tactics that are used, the strategies that are used, the bombardment of the advertising, the focus on the negativity, the effort to disqualify, demonize, destroy, if you will, the opposition, it makes it very much more difficult at the end of that election for the two sides to come together. I was struck in 2012 as I went around. One of the questions I would ask voters was this: what happens if your candidate loses? What do you think the consequences are? How do you see the stakes of this election? And on either side, the response was almost kind of apocalyptic in this sense, that if it was a Republican, I said, what do you think happens if President Obama were to win a second term? And any number of voters I talked to basically said, the America that I know and love will come to an end. I mean, they almost put it in terms that stark. And similarly, Democrats would say, if Mitt Romney were to win and had strength in the Congress to do what he wants to do, the Republicans will take the country in a terrible and disastrous direction. When you have those kinds of passions, it's hard after an election for people to say, well, okay, now let's go work together.
And is the old thought that you would say, well, you know, I didn't vote for him, but he's our president. He's my president. Is that something you no longer heard?
You hear less of that than you used to. That's certainly the case. Now, you heard some of that after 2008. I remember watching a focus group that Peter Hart, who's a Democratic pollster, but was doing focus groups for the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. And he convened a group in the Cincinnati area. And one of the questions he said was, put yourselves back on election night 2008. What were you thinking? What were you feeling? Tell me what you thought at that point. And there were Obama voters and McCain voters in this group. And several of the McCain voters said, despite the fact that the candidate that I voted for lost, I felt good about the country. I felt that this was an important moment, that we had broken a racial barrier in the country, and that we could all feel good about that, even if we were disappointed that our candidate lost. You heard very little of that in 2012. Yeah. At that point, it was, well, he's not my president, he's somebody else's president.
It's, and it reminds me that in some ways, I think one of Mitt Romney's most effective lines from his, I believe it was from his acceptance speech, is when he said, if you're an Obama supporter, your best night shouldn't be the day he was elected, that night in Grant Park.
Yes, and basically saying, if you're disappointed, it's because he disappointed you.
Right.
He did not live up to the expectations that you you set out for him.
You quote John Huntsman, the former governor of Utah and envoy to China under President Obama, in the way he describes the campaign and this question of excessive negativity. And Huntsman says, you rip the guts out of the other guy. You rip him down. You cut him to shreds. You eviscerate him. And that just wasn't my style. People could say, you've got to be that angry. You've got to rip the president. But I just work for him, for heaven's sakes. I was his envoy to China. He's a decent man. I can't do that. And even if I did, it would have come across as disingenuous. I'm just not going to play that game. And, of course, the John Huntsman candidacy went nowhere. What does that portend?
Well, I think it portends more of the same, frankly. I mean, John Huntsman lost for a variety of reasons. That campaign never really got off the ground, not simply because he was unwilling to do exactly those kinds of things that he was describing that he disliked so much. But put that aside, the nature of these campaigns is such that as you start out to think about running for president, one of the things you do is you go before different groups and you test out messages. And what we've seen in this current era is that the messages that are harsh have more resonance than the ones that are gentle. Hmm. And you can see this whether it's looking at some of the Republican candidates who are thinking of running in 2016, or one of the lessons that the Obama campaign took away from the debate in Denver last fall, when the president did very badly. One of the things they realized in this was that these debates were not forums for kind of reasoned analysis or persuading in a thoughtful way. That they were forums to, in part, energize your base, and you had to speak in a way that was different than you might have thought in the past. And so it has infected all aspects of the way we campaign.
Which brings us to why Newt Gingrich had the sort of remarkable run that he had for a while, because of his precise ability to do that.
He did. I mean, Newt Gingrich, by all rights, was done and gone by the summer of 2011, when his campaign team decided they didn't want to work for him anymore, and they left him alone. And the debates gave him a forum to resurrect his candidacy. And one of the things he did in those forums was he was particularly harsh on President Obama. Whenever he was asked to draw contrasts with his Republican opponents, he was more reluctant to do so, but he was full-throated in his denunciations of President Obama, and as an aside, toward some of the moderators in the debates.
Right.
But I remember speaking with two different groups of voters in Iowa in that period in late November of 2011, when Gingrich was kind of beginning to rise again. And one of the things that they said they liked most was that they thought that Newt Gingrich would be a formidable opponent to debate President Obama. They liked the way he was aggressive. They thought that his attacks on the president were just exactly what they wanted to hear. And it was one of the reasons, if not the main reason, that he was able to come back and for a time challenge Mitt Romney.
That desire to sort of focus on your base and to say the things that people are going to react to in the most visceral kind of way, in some ways also seems to me to relate to one of the other themes you focus on in the book, which are the great demographic changes in this country. They seem so obvious in so many ways, the way in which the population of the country has changed. And yet, in the section of your book which focuses on the Republican primary in particular, there's such little awareness of that. It seems remarkable in a way. And yet I guess it's for that very reason you're just describing. That's not what's going to excite your base.
No, that's right. And we're speaking, I think, most specifically about the Republicans' inability to do better with the Hispanic vote. It was as if they woke up the day after the election and said, oh, my goodness, we have a problem here. Now, some smart Republicans have been warning about this, as have others, for some time. Some of the people who were around George W. Bush, who was always sensitive to the Hispanic vote because of his experience in Texas, always said, we have got to figure out a way to attract more support in the Hispanic community. And yet, for much of the party, that was a non-starter. And the debates were, I think, quite damaging to the Republican Party as a whole, and certainly to Governor Romney, because of the way the immigration debate played out. I mean, if people remember, Rick Perry, the governor of Texas, got hammered right. by his opponents, including Governor Romney, for supporting a longstanding bill, act in Texas, which allowed the children of illegal immigrants to, if they were residents of the state, to attend colleges with in-state tuition. And he was pounded for this. And at one of the debates, he said, well, if you feel that way, you don't have a heart. And it was, I think it was the moment when his campaign effectively ended. And I know in talking to him about it, he believes that that was where his campaign effectively ended. So it was a problem throughout. And they've always thought there were other ways to attract Hispanic votes, but they've never consistently put forward a message that has done it.
And just to fast forward for a moment, Dan, to the next great campaign of in 2016 or in 2014, perhaps as well, the non-presidential election. Has that lesson been taken in? You see certainly some leaders of the Republican Party focusing on the need to put out a message that is more welcoming to Latino voters in particular. Or will we see a rerun of this, do you think?
Well, I think we're going to see some of both, actually. There are people who have embraced the idea that they've got to do something about immigration reform, for example. Marco Rubio, the senator from Florida, who is a prospective candidate in 2016, has been one of the leaders in the effort in the Senate to try to enact comprehensive reform that includes a path to citizenship for those who are here illegally. John McCain said a couple of weeks ago, if we pass immigration reform, it will not win us one additional Hispanic vote. But what it will do is put us on the playing field where we can begin to compete more effectively for those voters. For another part of the Republican Party, the harshness in their language about immigration reform, their resistance to anything that provides a path to legal status for those who are here, causes a disconnect. And I think one of the features we're going to see in 2016 is many of the people who we're talking about as prospective candidates have come out in favor of exactly what Rubio has come out in favor of. But we don't know what the base will respond with when they get out on the campaign trail. And it's possible that some of the leaders of the party could be in favor of it. But if a good part of the party is full-throated in its opposition, it will negate some of the possibilities of them making some gains.
Is the debate then, or the focus on purity on both the Republican and Democratic sides, still central to all of this? You quote Haley Barbour of Mississippi in his sort of disparaging view of too much purity. He says, politics is about addition and multiplication. Purity is about subtraction and division. But it doesn't seem like that view prevails, at least right now in the Republican Party, that purity trumps the ability to multiply.
Well, to a certain extent, that's right. Haley Barbour is a pretty shrewd politician, and he has always tried to practice the politics of addition and multiplication. Any party that aspires to be the majority party in this country is a coalition of disparate groups and sometimes fractious groups. And I think one of the arguments that will be even more central as we go toward 2016 than it was in 2012 is, what is the right formula? What is the right message? What is the combination of policies for the Republicans to attract not just to energize their base, but to attract people who are reluctant or have been reluctant to support their presidential nominee. And there are different paths that different candidates will be offering. And I think that that foreshadows an important debate for the Republican Party, in a sense, just as the Democrats went through at the end of the Reagan-Bush era and Bill Clinton came in 1992 and kind of had to redefine what the Democratic Party was about. I don't know whether we'll see that in 2016, a redefinition of the Republican Party, but certainly that is part of the question that the Republicans will be debating.
Dan Baltz is our guest this hour, chief correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the new book Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. Just want to get your thoughts for a moment, and then we'll come back to more of what you spell out in your book about 2016. I was thinking about this morning about who the potential Republican candidates might be, and then we'll spend a moment on the Democratic side as well. In the Republican Party, there often seems to be this tendency to nominate the person who's tried once before. It's almost like giving the guy the gold watch on his second try. And if you look back at Republican nominees, all of them had run once before they got the nomination. Reagan tried in 76, got the nomination in 80. George H.W. Bush had tried in 80, finally got it in 88. Bob Dole had tried, finally got it in 96. McCain had tried in 2000, got it in 2012. Romney had tried in 2008, got it in 2012. Only George W. Bush got it the first time around. Is that just sort of a quirky little thing that happens to fascinate me, or is there any significance in that?
No, there is significance to it, and it has been a pattern in the Republican Party in particular. I remember some years ago, Republicans saying we're kind of like, you know, the community bank, and the senior vice president is the next president, and once the president retires, the senior vice president moves up, and that's the way it's been in our nomination process. You know, it's not clear that will be the case in 2016. Rick Santorum, who did obviously pretty well in 2012, is out there as a prospective candidate. He will have benefited from going through the process. He will know the mistakes he made and the things he did right. And just as Mitt Romney was a more effective candidate in the Republican nomination battle the second time around, Rick Santorum might also. Rick Perry, who had pretty disastrous introduction as a presidential candidate, is talking about running again. Curiously, neither of them ranks very highly in the very early and therefore, the questionable polls, but the early polls of rank and file Republicans. This is in many ways as wide open a Republican race as we've seen in a long time. And it's not at all clear that the experience of having run in 2012 will be a major benefit in 2016. I think one of the reasons for that, Dave, is that you have a new generation of Republicans coming online to be national candidates. They were in essence a cycle away in 2012. They weren't quite ready to run. Some of the governors who were only elected in 2010, or in Chris Christie's case, 2009, it was just too soon to run in 2012. Many of them will be out there at least testing the waters and maybe active candidates. So you've got a different mix of people, and you've got a party that's, again, as we've said, looking for a way to win presidentially. And that, I think, will create a different dynamic than some that we've seen in the past.
Dan Baltz, his new book, Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll talk about the likely Democratic prospects in 2016. I bet you can think of who that might be. And we'll also talk more about lessons learned from 2012, the implications of the great technological advantage, the Obama campaign, and what that will say about how Republicans may try to catch up. We'll talk about all of that when we return. We'd like to hear from you, too. Join us at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. This is Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson, in today for Michael Krasny. Dan Baltz is our guest, chief correspondent for The Washington Post and author of Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. If you have a question for Dan Baltz about 2012 or 2016 or any election past or present or future, you can join us at 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org, post your questions or thoughts on our Facebook page or website. And by the way, speaking of posting things on our Facebook or website, I mentioned in the introduction that there'd already been a David Yepsen sighting in Iowa. Probably Dan Baltz may be the only person who knows what I mean by that. But if you know and want to tweet in that or post that, do so, and we'll fill in at some point over the next half hour what in the world I'm talking about. In the meantime, Dan Baltz, on the Democratic side, everyone's thinking about one person. You wrote about her the other day, Hillary Clinton. In your judgment, is that where we're likely to head?
Well, she is certainly the person to beat. She'll decide in a number of months whether she's truly going to be in the race or not. Every indication we have and all the activities she's taking part in right now suggests that she's doing everything a candidate would do at this stage in the cycle. Maybe she'll wake up in a year and decide she likes a quieter life, but everything she's doing at this point suggests she is likely to be a candidate for president. If that's the case, she begins this campaign in a very formidable position. She is well ahead in all of any early polls among Democrats as their choice for Democratic nominee. Now, she was well ahead in,
right,
when she was running in 2008. So, A, you have to take that with a little bit of grain of salt, but B, there's no equivalent of a Barack Obama on the horizon, mm-hmm, to challenge her in 2016. He was already at this stage in that last race a phenomenon and a political rock star. So that's one difference. So she may have a clearer path toward the Democratic nomination than she did before. But, that was a campaign in which she and her campaign made some significant mistakes that I think contributed to a defeat in an election or a contest that by all rights she should have won rather than lost. So she's got some work to do to make sure that this campaign is fully up to speed in all the ways, or in many of the ways, the last one was not.
Just one more question on the Hillary Clinton candidacy or its possibility. A guest yesterday on our program, Susan Kennedy, who is a lifelong Democratic activist here in California, but served most recently as Arnold Schwarzenegger's chief of staff. I asked her in that interview if she looked forward to a Hillary candidacy, and she said, "I look forward to a Hillary presidency, but I hate the thought of what could happen in a campaign and what she would have to go through, and that might perhaps, she has accomplished so much, she's become such an icon for women in politics, that if she went through another campaign, that could easily, unless she became president, tarnish her great accomplishments and great legacy." Is that a real risk, do you think?
It is a potential risk. I know Susan and I respect her views on things. I think it's an important point. When she left as Secretary of State at the beginning of this year, she was in a very enviable position. She was admired. She was very popular. By all indications, she was one of the most well thought of people in the political world in the United States. That was in part because for the last 4 years, she was not in the political fray itself. It's not that she was free from controversy. We know that she wasn't. But the Secretary of State is not somebody who's out campaigning day to day and generally not somebody who's in the line of fire from the opposition in quite the same way that a candidate is. That will all change, and it has begun to change as Republicans see her as a prospective candidate, and it will only intensify. I mean, there is a lot of history that she will have to deal with, and there is a lot of animosity toward the Clintons among Republicans that will come to the fore. I mean, she is not going to be seen in the campaign by her opponents as someone who is free from criticism or attack. And depending, we know these campaigns are long and they are brutal, and she will have to go through that. She knows what it will be like because she's been through it herself, and she's seen what her husband went through, and she's seen what Barack Obama has gone through, and knows what these campaigns can, the toll they can take. So it is a risk. There's no guarantee, even as strong as she is as a potential candidate, that she would have anything approaching an easy path to the presidency. This is a divided country, and she comes with a lot of history that will only kind of intensify some of the opposition.
And to our callers, let's start out with Kevin in San Jose. Kevin, go ahead with your question for Dan Baltz.
Good morning. I have two questions. Normally, I have a lot of respect and even awe for the Republican thinking about polling and all that, but they always choose lousy running mates, Palin and Quayle, you know, to begin with. You know, two old white guys, you know, conservative white guys running in an era of diversity that was doomed from the beginning, more symbolic than anything else. Question number two is, the Christian right was kind of given credit for being the foot soldiers who kind of won the election in probably 2000, 2004. Are they not impacting anymore? Do they just not care anymore? Or what has happened to their influence?
Yeah, thank you, Kevin. Much. Yeah. Well, start with the last one, if you would, Dan.
The Christian right has been a part of the base of the modern Republican Party, a very important element, particularly through the 90s and the early 2000s. I think there has been some splintering of the Christian right. They still play an important role. Religious conservatives, social conservatives still play an important role in the presidential nominating process. But there's an interesting factoid in the book, which is this. In every caucus or primary where I could find data, if the percentage of evangelicals was above 50%, Mitt Romney lost that contest. Huh. If it was below 50%, he won the contest. So in part, you could say, yes, they are influential, but they are not decisive even in picking the nominee. If a candidate can get some of that vote, they can win even if they get a minority of that vote. Organizationally, I think they are not as effective as they used to be. The movement doesn't have the visibility of some of the leadership that it once had, whether it was Jerry Falwell or later Pat Robertson or someone like Ralph Reed, all of whom were effective at leading the organization. And I think more important than that, just giving some visibility and coherence to those voters. So there have been some changes. They are still very important in the party, but there are other elements of the party that also play a role.
I'm trying to remember. I think it was in maybe it was 92 or 96 that Pat Robertson either won or came close to winning the Iowa caucus. It's hard. It's a little bit hard to imagine that prospect in the future. On Kevin's other question about running mates, Paul Ryan probably wouldn't like the characterization as an old white guy. But what about that?
A young white
process?
Guy. Yeah. Well, you know, I think Dan Quayle is the example of if vice presidential candidates made a big difference in the outcome of an election, he disproves that. He had a very bad introduction, as we remember, as a vice presidential candidate, and in the end, George H.W. Bush won that race rather easily. And so I believe that vice presidential candidates in the end don't make a lot of difference in the outcome of an election. I don't think John McCain lost because of Sarah Palin. One could argue that maybe he would have done a little bit better had she not been there. On the other hand, we know that her addition to the ticket energized the Republican Party around that candidacy in a way that it had not been before she was there. So you could say that, you know, at worst she may have been a wash for John McCain. So I don't think so. I think the issue of diversity is important. The changing demographics of the country are, as we talked about at the beginning, significant, and they are continuing. And the Republican nominees, Mitt Romney, got, I think, 9 of every 10 of his votes from white voters. And that is not a recipe for victory in the future in an America that continues to become more diverse.
John in San Francisco, your question for Dan Baltz.
Hi, good morning. My question concerns John Boehner and the House. They seem to have a policy these days that unless a bill has majority support among Republicans, that it will not be voted on in the House. That's the first time that such a policy has come to my attention, and I was wondering whether there might be any history there.
Dan?
Well, the history of it is it goes back to Dennis Hastert when he was the speaker, and it's informally dubbed the Hastert rule. And it, as you describe it, it is that they're not going to try to push through legislation if they're in the majority that doesn't have a majority of the majority, a majority support among the Republicans. You know, in a sense, this is practical politics. The House is not the Senate. The Senate rules, because of the 60-vote threshold for getting a lot of things done, require more cross-party cooperation. It is possible for more amendments to be offered in the Senate than in the House. If you're in the majority in the House, you have the ability to really control the calendar and to set the terms of debate for any piece of legislation. Now, for John Boehner, on some of these bills that are coming forward, I mean, he had to deal with this at the end of last year with the tax legislation and the fiscal cliff, and he's going to have to deal with this perhaps on immigration. You can only bring so many bills to the floor that have a minority support in your own party and hope to retain your speakership. If you're the leader of your party, you ought to be able to get a majority of your own party behind the things that you think ought to go to the floor. So it's a test of leadership. It's a measure of kind of the unruliness that exists within the Republican Party in the House in particular. And it's a challenging moment for somebody like John Boehner, who isn't a natural Tea Party person, you know, who has worked with Democrats in the past when he was chairman of the House Education Committee. He worked with George Miller from California and with George W. Bush and with Ted Kennedy to get the No Child Left Behind bill through. But he's in a different environment, and he has to strike the right balance.
John, thanks for the call. Up next is Neil, also calling from San Francisco this morning. Neil, go ahead.
Yeah, I'd like to know if you have an opinion yet of Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia, who seems enormously promising to me, especially if Hillary should decide not to run, or even if she does later on, he should become a very prominent party leader. Have you formed any opinion of him yet?
Well, he's a very able senator. He was a very able governor. Virginia right now has two Democratic senators, either one of whom could be part of a national ticket at some point. Mark Warner, who was governor before Tim Kaine and came to the Senate a few years before Tim Kaine, actually considered running in a prior election and got his feet wet and then decided he didn't actually want to become a candidate and ended up in the Senate. But he's quite a talented person. He's more of a centrist Democrat. Tim Kaine had a very close relationship with Barack Obama and we thought in 2008 he might end up on the ticket with Obama. Instead, it was Senator and now Vice President Biden. But both of them have real talents. I think that all folks like that are kind of on hold at this point because of the space occupied by Senator Clinton, Secretary Clinton, and also by Vice President Biden. I mean, if Clinton runs, I don't think Biden will. If Clinton doesn't run, I'm not sure Biden will, but I think that people would look to him next to decide whether he was going to get in the race and then decide whether they wanted to get into that race with him. So I think people are waiting and watching some of the bigger figures in the party right now.
Sometimes in elections, Dan, we look for someone who represents a new approach or a balance to whatever the candidate or president was who preceded Barack Obama to some extent, this person who we thought might bring together red and blue after the polarizing president of George W. Bush. Do you have any sense of what might be a reaction to Barack Obama? You described him earlier as someone who's sometimes seems to be thinking that, well, I'm a smart guy and I talk to other smart guys and that ought to be enough. I mean, do you have a sense of whether a reaction to Obama might put forward a Chris Christie, for example, someone who is much more out there than a Barack Obama?
It's very possible. David Axelrod, who has been Barack Obama's chief strategist through both of these campaigns, said before the 2008 campaign, he's always had this theory that that voters are often seeking a replacement, not a replica, for the incumbent president. And that's particularly true in difficult times. It was certainly true with George W. Bush. And I don't think we know at this point what the impression of President Obama's strengths and weaknesses will be as we get closer to 2016. I mean, one of the criticisms of him is that he's not been able to work his will with Congress more effectively, that he isn't a schmoozer, that he doesn't have the qualities of Lyndon Johnson, who was a master of the Senate when he was majority leader and skillful at working this Congress when he was president. One point on that, I'm not sure LBJ could be LBJ today. We're in a much different environment. To some extent, President Obama's inability to get things done is simply because he's had such a strong and unified Republican opposition. But it may be that as people look at this, they will say, well, we do need somebody who is more capable and relishes more the working of the insides of the Congress. Maybe that is a Chris Christie. Maybe it's a Hillary Clinton, who used to be in the Senate and had a good record of success working across party lines, at least on some things. We don't know, but I think that it's an important point as to whether there will be a judgment on what are the qualities that President Obama lacked, and does somebody have those, and if they have them, will it actually make any difference?
George in San Jose. Go ahead with your question for Dan Baltz.
Yes. How badly did the Republican primaries ultimately damage the Romney campaign? I'm thinking in particular the hyperbolic rhetoric from Newt Gingrich when Newt referred to Romney as a maniacal liar. If that had come from a demo, I think voters would just ignore it as opposition rhetoric. But when it comes from a respected member of the Republican candidate's own party, I think that gives voters a lot of pause as to whether Romney has some kind of fundamental character flaw.
Well, Newt Gingrich was really angry at that particular point in the Republican campaign. I did a series of interviews with the former speaker during the course of the campaign that were embargoed until the book came out last week, and you can see in what he had to say in real time how angry he was at Governor Romney. I think that the bigger damage that was done to Governor Romney through the course of the primaries was simply the nature of the debate that they were all going through, and those many debates that he was on stage with the rest of the field. This was not a strong field. Rick Perry had a great line after he was out of the race. He spoke at the annual Gridiron Dinner in Washington, and he said, "I ran against the weakest Republican field ever, and they kicked my behind." And there was truth on both fronts. Governor Romney made some mistakes in those debates, which I think always hurt him, particularly on the immigration issue. His line about self-deportation, which he frankly did not think was harsh or punitive, and was shocked at the reaction to it. But nonetheless, I think that hurt him. I think that the collective view of the Republican Party as being farther to the right than it had been made it more difficult for Governor Romney to kind of navigate back to a more comfortable place closer to the center of the electorate. I think all of those things added up. Stuart Stevens, who was Romney's chief strategist, I was talking to him after the election for the book, and we talked about the impact of the debates. And he had his summation was, it's like high school. You become who you hang out with. And that he felt that Romney was, in his view, unfairly tagged by the views people took away from some of the other candidates who were seeking the Republican nomination.
One of the things that becomes clear in reading your book, Dan, that is that it seems like Mitt Romney was someone who just never could quite get the significance of some of the things that he said, whether it was comments about self-deportation or, you know, his bet with – what was the bet with Rick Perry? You want to bet $10,000? That he didn't think of that as being kind of a high number. Or even the famous 47% comment, which – let me just read again where he said, "My job is not to worry about those people. I'll never convince them that they should take personal responsibility and care for their lives." When you interviewed him after the election, he was still trying to explain that. He didn't seem to ever really get that he was the consequence of the things he said.
I think what he didn't get was that he had actually said what he said. When I reminded him of exactly what you just read, he said, "I didn't say that." And we were sitting in comfortable chairs in his home outside of Boston, and he got up and he walked over to the kitchen counter and pulled his iPad out of the charger and brought it back and scrolled through to find some notes that he had made. And he started to read those notes, and I recount that in the book. But he was trying to say he didn't say exactly that. And I think what he was really saying was, whatever the exact words were, it did not reflect my heart. It did not reflect what I really mean or feel. And yet he realized that that moment was terribly damaging to his candidacy, that it in fact reinforced the view that he was out of touch with the lives of a lot of people in America who held the election perhaps in the balance. He knows how much it hurt him. He thought he was able to come back from that because of a good performance in the Denver debate. But I asked him right near the end of our pretty lengthy interview, I said, "Governor, as you look back on this and think about where America was in 2012, a country in which a lot of people are struggling and they look at wealthy people and think, you know, they're doing just fine and I'm being left behind." I said, "Someone with your profile, your background, your wealth," I said, "maybe it just was impossible for somebody like you to be elected in this environment." And he said he knew that his background would be a potential obstacle. But he said, "I thought I could overcome it." And obviously, in the end, he could not overcome it.
A couple of people writing, Dan, about the impact of gerrymandering and redistricting and how that will play out in future congressional elections. Mitchell writes, "Gerrymandering is the linchpin of gridlock. If all House seats were contested in fair districts, the House would be in Democratic control, a very different governing equation. After all, Democrats received more votes for the House than Republicans did in 2012. John makes a similar comment about the impact of safe districts. Is that'll likely continue to be the way in which congressional elections will be determined in 2014, yeah?
Yes, and it's a point of contention, obviously, the way the district lines are drawn and the process by which we draw them, which is a political process. There are a few states that have gone to a non-political approach, or as best they can, with certain requirements that the districts not be, not look like, Jackson Pollock paintings, but look like something that's some form that we recognize. This is right that the Republicans lost the popular vote for the House in 2012, but ended up with more seats. Partly that is a result of the way the district lines are drawn. The truth is, whether it's Democratic seats or Republican seats, there are very few or many fewer contestable seats than there once were. And this is something that both Republicans and Democrats have done. I mean, they've both participated in this, but the Republicans got the upper hand the last time around because they ended up controlling a lot of states where they could draw lines. I think this is a problem. I don't think it is the silver bullet in terms of ending the gridlock or paralysis that we've seen. And for one reason is that people now tend to live in places that are more akin to what they think, and they like to live around people who think the way they do. So I think red areas have gotten a little redder and blue areas have gotten a little bluer. So there's no easy way out of this.
Jim writes, how much did race play in the president's difficulties in getting anything through Congress? Would the process be different if President Obama were white instead of black?
Well, I think it's an unanswerable question. I know that in talking to the president in the past campaign, I was not able to interview him for this book, but in the past campaign, he always thought that the issue of race was something of a wash for him, at least in 2008. He said, I know that there are some people who will not vote for me because I'm black, and that there are perhaps some people who will vote for me who because I'm black, and some white voters who would vote for him because he was black. There's no question that there is some racial animosity on the part of some people. You know, when the Supreme Court neutered the Voting Rights Act earlier this summer, one of the things that the justices said was discrimination in this country has not ended. And Hillary Clinton spoke about this again out west just this week. But in terms of, is that the main reason that things aren't getting done in Congress? I don't think that's the case. I think that there are a variety of factors that are more the reason than that.
We just have time for a last quick thought. As you sort of think about the compilation of lessons learned from 2012 and look forward to 2016, what do you take from it? What do you think the through line will be? Will we get any better at overcoming those differences, be they race or be they red versus blue? What will we have gained from 2012 that may inform what happens in 2016?
Well, I think that unless some candidate can miraculously break through this, that we're in for an evolutionary period rather than a revolutionary period in terms of ending the red-blue divide. I think that we have a few more elections to go before we perhaps get out of this, and I don't know whether that will be the case. There are a lot of things that happened in this election in terms of the nuts and bolts that I think will be instrumental in the way campaigns in the future are run, particularly in terms of technology and analytics, social media, those kinds of things. Super PACs are a force that are now part of the political future that we're in. So there are those things. But I think, you know, it goes back to what we talked about at the beginning. There are big forces that shape the politics. And one is demographics, and two is the ideological divisions that now exist in the country and the passions with which people hold those views.
Dan Baltz, the book Collision 2012, Obama versus Romney and the Future of Elections in America. You can read an excerpt of Dan's book, by the way, on our website. I have to ask you a last quick question. Who's David Yepsen?
David Yepsen is the legendary political reporter for the Des Moines Register, who now, I believe, is still running the Paul Simon Center at Southern Illinois University. But any presidential candidate who went to Iowa always wanted to talk first to David Yepsen.
Thank you, Dan. Dan Baltz, thanks so much for being part of our program today.
Thank you, Dave.
Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, and Tina Lorberg. Danny Bringer is our engineer. Dan Zoll, our senior editor. Raul Ramirez, our executive producer. Amanda Stupai, our engagement producer. I'm Dave Iverson. In today for Michael Krasny. This is Forum on KQED.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.